Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome. We're delighted that you're with us this morning as we continue on with our series on Life's Too Short. Now, last week we started out this series by examining the prayer of Moses, which is found in Psalm 90. Verse 12 says this, "Teach us." Remember, these are the words, this is the prayer of Moses, the man of God. "Teach us to number our days and recognize how few they are. Help us to spend them as we should." Now, a little bit of history here about this verse, I think, will help you to understand better what Moses had in mind. This prayer was prayed and recorded during the time of the wilderness wandering of the children of Israel. You know, many times I think we fail to remember that the route from Egypt to the Promised Land in reality was only an 11-month journey. It was an 11-month journey that we all know took 40 years to get there. But why did it take 40 years? What was going on? Well, as you read the account, you'll discover that 12 men were sent out once they had reached the border of the Canaan land, the Promised Land. 12 men were sent into the land to check it out. And they returned back with their report saying, "It is indeed a good land that is flowing with milk and honey. Matter of fact, the land and its provision is even more than we could have ever dreamt of. It's a wonderful place. It's everything that God had promised." But then, as you well know, the report became rather negative. And they began to say, "Well, we can't take the land, however, because there's giants in the land. The cities are impenetrable, and we are like grasshoppers in their sight." Of the 12 spies, as you will remember, only two remained faith-filled and positive, and the two were Joshua and Caleb. And the Bible tells us, because of their unbelief and because of their rejection of God's land and promise that God had given to them, God decided that all of these that had complained and said, "We wish that we would have just died back in Egypt or died out here somewhere in this wilderness, because you have brought us this far and there's no way we'll ever take this land." God then, in his anger, said, "You'll have it just as you wanted it. Every person above the age of 20 will die in this wilderness. You will not go into the land that I have promised." And so we read then, for the next 39 years, these 39 years were needless years of wandering and death. Now, it's very plausible that during these 39 years that Moses was leading them throughout the wilderness, a million or more persons may have died. That's right, a million or more. When you break that down into 39 years, in a daily basis, there would have been 70 persons every single day that started out on the journey, 70 friends that walked side by side, 70 friends that walked through the dried up, you know, Red Sea so they could walk over in dry land. Yes, 70 deaths per day, every single day, 365 days out of the year for 39 years. Let me tell you, that's a depressing kind of place to be, isn't it? You're surrounded by death. Every single day, 70 more die. And in those days, you're burying and you're having ceremonial, you know, times over those who have died. It's a heartbreaking place to be at. It's no wonder then, in the midst of this, that Moses declares, 70 dying every single day, every single week, 490 different individuals being buried. He says, life is short. Matter of fact, he likens life. He said, it's like the grass that is green in the spring and throughout the summer months, but then it dries up and it dies in the fall. It's only here for a season. He said, life is like the morning dew. It's gone by noon. He says, life is like a shadow. It's fleeting. It's only for a quick moment. Surrounded then every single day by the reality of death, Moses prayed. He says, teach us to number our days and recognize how few they are and help us to spend them as we should. I think in modern vernacular, we would say, with so much to do and so little time, how can we make the most out of every day? God, show us how to spend our time. Show us how to spend our energies. God, help us not to waste our lives away. Show us how to live every single moment of every single day, how to make the most and to live it to the full. You see, living every day in that environment of death, Moses came to the conclusion that life was short. Life was critically short. Matter of fact, I would say Moses is declaring life is too short not to enjoy every God-given day, too short to live every day in anxiety and fear, too short to major on minors, too short to go to bed most nights angry at someone, too short to hold a grudge. Yes, life is too short to hold a grudge. Long before there was ever anything that was called reality television, the Bible meticulously recorded the lives and events of real people so that we could learn from their lives and from their example. Being a book of reality, and that's what the Bible is, the book of the scriptures, it is a sacred book, but it's also a book of reality, a book that records the good, the bad, and even the downright ugly side of life. Now, with that in mind, let's turn to Genesis chapter 27. In Genesis chapter 27, we find here an account that graphically records the destructive power of a grudge within a family. To make a long story short, out of Genesis 27, here's what you'll discover. Jacob, by means of trickery and deceit, you know the story, he stole away the patriarchal blessing of his father Isaac, which was intended for his twin brother Esau. Listen to the outcome in verse 41. And I want you to let this verse sink into your heart because it's got a lot to say about the subject this morning. Esau held a grudge against Jacob, which was his brother, because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. Friends, most grudges in life, they began rather simply. You know, and it's not a grudge, you know, that comes about in, you know, in most lives as a result of somebody beating you up or burning your house down. It's usually the small stuff of life. Most grudges come out of an insult. An insult that maybe was not even intended, but nonetheless, you took it as an insult, and therefore, there's a grudge that begins to grow inside of your heart towards that individual. Maybe it's a simple slight. Maybe you were overlooked and someone else got the job. Maybe someone else got the credit for what you have done. And at that moment, something begins to stir on the inside, and this something in time turns into an outright grudge. Maybe it's a perceived unfairness. Something happened, you said, this is not fair at all. Or maybe it was out of embarrassment. Something happened, it embarrassed you, and an individual was attached to that day, that time, that season, and that embarrassment. And so life is made up of grudges that come out of insults, simple slights, perceived unfairness, and embarrassment. Now, friends, I don't remember a whole lot from my psychology classes in college, but this one phrase I remember. This phrase was burned into our hearts over and over again by a professor. He said this, a hurt ego is a mean ego. So when any of the above, the insult, the slight, the unfair situation, the embarrassment, it hurts our ego And a hurt ego becomes a what? Say it. A mean ego. You know, grudges are more about us than they are about others in reality. A grudge is usually something that we have come up with to defend ourselves against these slights, these embarrassing moments. And so in reality, the grudge is more about us than it is about others. Grudges, they often very quickly morph. They start out something like this. In the beginning of it, that insult, that slight, that embarrassing moment, you did this to me. And it is based upon the fact that something did happen. Whether it was something that was misguided, or whether it was something that was intentional or unintentional, it starts out, we know something happened. And so you did this to me is the way we justify this in our minds. However, it will quickly morph from there to the point where you are this to me. And suddenly what happened is now secondary. The fact that we dislike the individual and want to hold them accountable for their actions and their deeds, whether perceived or whether in reality, it turns from you did this to me to you are this to me. Esau, he threatened Jacob. He said, as soon as Dad dies, you're going to be dead as well. He said, I'll wait until Dad dies because I don't want my father to have to experience what it's like to having lost his son by murder. And so I'm going to just hold fast. But you know, Dad is old, and Dad is old and gray, and time is limited for him. And when Dad dies, I'm going to kill you, is what he said to his brother. You see, Esau then threatened Jacob. And he said, you're done for. You know, by definition, a grudge is a deep-seated feeling of resentment or rancor. That is what it is. At its root, a grudge then is a deep-seated feeling of resentment. You resent what happened, and you resent the person, especially, that had a role or part in it. Grudges are often accompanied by thoughts of retaliation. Now, sometimes these retaliations can be as extreme as what it is in the case of Esau saying to his brother, you're going to die. You've embarrassed me. You've been taking advantage of my life. And you are one day going to die. But in most cases, it's not that. Many days, it'll start out something like this. For a man, you're looking in the mirror and you're shaving in the morning, and you begin to go through your mind all the things you would say if you were to encounter that individual throughout that day. For you ladies, it may be while you're putting on your makeup. But we begin to rehearse in our mind. We're beginning to plot this thing out. Remember, it is seeking revenge. It is seeking resentment and rancor. And so they're often then accompanied by these thoughts of planning and plotting retaliation. I think so often of a day that I was in the nursing home visiting one of the saints of God from our congregation. And I was just finishing up reading the scriptures with this lady, and I was just getting ready to leave her room after having prayed with her and having a time of fellowship. Just as I was leaving the room, a little lady came up to me, and she's in her wheelchair. And she has the biggest smile on her face, and I thought when I saw her, wow, she's got some happy news. And she said to me, do you know what I'm going to do tonight? And I thought, okay, must be a birthday or a celebration or something. She says, do you know what I'm going to do tonight? I said, no, I do not. And she said, I'm going to kill my roommate tonight. And she had actually snuck in with her wheelchair under some clothing and some stuff. She brought in a big rock, and she had this rock hid under the sheets in her room. And she'd been planning this thing out. Now, you also need to know, she did not know what day of the week it was. She did not know what her last meal was. She did not know when her next bath was going to be, but she was absolutely livid in planning this grudge against her roommate. In time, these things will take over. And when our conscious memory and our ability to filter out, you see, all of us, when we have our right mind, are able to filter what is the right thing to say and what may not be the right thing, and even in actions, what may be right actions and what is not. But if the Lord should tarry, in many cases, the conscious memory is all that is left. And the conscious memory is, you know, deep-seated, it's deep within us, and it's out of that conscious memory, whatever we've been feeding it, and this lady had been feeding hatred and revenge for so long, though she didn't know the day of the week and her last meal or her next bath, she had planned out that night she was going to kill her roommate. I went down to the nurse's station. I said, you know, I think that you better get that rock out of that room. And so they said, oh, no, not again. Not again. This was not the first time, and probably, sadly, not the last. So grudges, then, they're often accompanied by thoughts of retaliation, and there's plotting and there's planning involved. And sometimes, yes, it is something as destructive as hiding a rock and to kill your roommate, but possibly it's just you're going to tell them off when you get the chance. You're going to give them a piece of your mind as soon as you have that opportunity. You know, I find it very interesting, whenever you talk about a grudge, there is four different terms that are oftentimes coupled with it. I'll show you what I mean. Oftentimes, when talking about a grudge, the word that is used to talk about a grudge is holding a grudge. Isn't that interesting? They hold a grudge. And the word there literally means they grasp, they grip, they hold on to. This is theirs. They're going to hold on to this thing called a grudge. So they are holding a grudge. Another word that is used, they're nursing a grudge. Literally, it means they are nurturing, they're feeding it. They are bathing it like a child would be bathed by a nurse. Someone is caring for this thing every single day because they know if they don't care for it, it's going to die. And so to keep it alive, to make sure that it's alive, they nurse the grudge. Another term that's often used is they're carrying a grudge. And they've been carrying a grudge, they'll say, for X number of years. Yes, carrying a grudge, which simply means they move from place to place, bringing their grudge with them. They move from Milwaukee to Florida. Guess what? As soon as they get to Florida and get settled there, it's not long, and they're talking about their what? Say it. But their grudge. And they move from Florida to Alaska. And in Alaska, it's not long, and they're talking about their what? Their grudge. They move to a new location. They have new surroundings, whatever. But here's what they're doing. It's like they're literally packing up along with their goods and taking with them their grudge. They carry a grudge. Another term that's often used is bearing a grudge, or they bore a grudge. Bearing a grudge literally means they transport it, just like carrying it about. So when you hear the terms regarding a grudge, most times one of these four are going to accompany it. They're holding a grudge, they're nursing a grudge, they're carrying a grudge, they're bearing a grudge. That's pretty insightful, isn't it? Because it lets us know here that a grudge, then, is something that we embrace. It's something we take with us. It is something we carry along. It's something we move from day to day and from state to state and from life to life, just always holding this same old grudge of something that happened somewhere in the past. The Hebrew word for a grudge is a rather insightful thing. The word in the Hebrew is sawtam. We would spell it phonetically like saw, S-A-W-T-A-M. Sawtam, which literally means to cherish animosity. Isn't that interesting? They absolutely cherish the feeling of their animosity towards someone else. And friend, here's the deal. If you hold a grudge long enough, that grudge will begin to define who you are in time. We've all heard someone, you know, say, well, they're a bitter person. They're a person that carries grudges. They're an angry person. They're a mean-spirited individual. It literally begins to define the grudge in time, begins to defy our very character and our makeup. And when people think of us, they think of us in the light of what we are most of the time, and that is carrying this grudge, cherishing animosity. Esau's grudge ultimately became something that defined him. Look at Genesis chapter 27 once again. Now, with everything we've said, I want you to listen with the ear that a grudge is something that's planned, something that's plotted, something that has a starting point, but it morphs, and it brings about retaliation. Listen to this account now as we read it, starting with verse 41. Now Esau, what's the next word there, church? Put it on the screen for him, please. Esau what?
Held.
There's the term, isn't it? Some translations that you may be reading from this morning may say bore. And so it's saying, here's someone that holds something, is bearing something. Esau, he held a what?
Grudge.
And this grudge is against Jacob. Now notice here, there's a starting point. Because the blessing his father had given him. Remember, he had by deception and deceit received that blessing that belonged to Esau. So Esau held a grudge against Jacob because the blessing, that's the starting point, his father had given him. For he said to himself, notice here, he's rehearsing this every single day in his life. For he said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near. Dad is old and gray. He won't be around much longer. Then, here's the retaliation. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. Now, when Rebekah was told what her older son Esau had said, she sent for her younger son Jacob and said to him, your brother Esau is what? Planning, there it is again, planning to avenge himself by doing what? Killing you. Now then, my son, do what I say. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay with him for a while until your brother's fury subsides. When your brother is no longer angry with you and forgets what you have done to him or did to him, I'll send word for you to come back from there. Why should I lose both of you in one day? Sadly, as you read on to the entire account, a full 20 years passes by where these two brothers never saw each other, never talked to each other, no communication. It was all broke off. One was living in one place, the other in another. And when they did finally see each other after 20 years of being separated, as you read the account, it was a quick and it was a very fearful encounter. They didn't know if they would kill each other at that time or not. Then, sadly, when you think of this account, then sadly, each one, along with their families, after this very short encounter, after 20 years, they both went their own separate ways, not to meet again until their father's funeral, which was 30 years later yet. Friends, life is too short to hold a grudge. I've seen this played out. Family members have been separated from one another. Something happened. Something was said. There was some misunderstanding. It may have been over the family will. It could have been over a whole lot of things in life. But nonetheless, this thing just takes on a life of its own. At first, it was what you did, but now it's who you are. I despise you, and I despise you to the point I no longer even want any kind of relationship with you. And so I'm going to wipe you off. I'm going to just forget about you. But then the funeral comes. Friends, I have stood alongside of so many caskets where it's so easy to identify this group over here is against that group over there. But out of courtesy to the deceased, they'll come back for the funeral. And so it was between these two brothers, Esau and Jacob. 30 years after their last encounter, 50 years in total of being separated, they gather together for the funeral of Dad. I've seen so many. That's the only time they'll come together. And what a sad occasion it is, because now the one that was the glue of holding the family together is gone, and there's nothing that holds the rest of the family together. It's every man for his own, and everyone is doing their own thing, and this one's angry about that, and this one won't speak about this to that family member, and it's all caught up in division and strife. Just think about it for a moment, that all these two brothers missed out on. They missed out on doing family life together. They missed out on seeing their nephews and nieces grow up. They missed out on seeing each other's grandchildren and sowing into one another's lives. They missed out on all celebrations. They missed out on the festivals and the high holy days when they could have been together worshiping God together. And all the feasts, they missed out. A total, yes, of 50 years of family life gone down the drain, never to be recovered. As you read through the Bible, you'll discover that this grudge between Esau and his brother Jacob is not the only one in the Bible. The Bible, remember, is a book of reality. It's real lives. And the Bible says these real lives are recorded so that we look at their life, see the life they lived, and then choose how we are going to live. And if we live by the way they lived, we can expect the same kind of results. And so in some cases, it's a warning in the Bible. It's a warning, don't live this way. And in other cases, it's an example saying, wow, this is the way to live life. This is the way to live family life. This is the way to live out your marriage. This is the way to deal with difficulties. And so we have both the good, the bad, and the extremely ugly all listed in Scripture. And you'll find this grudge is not the only one. You can read about Joseph and his brothers. His brothers hated him so much, had a grudge against him, they were going to kill him. Then they thought the better of it, and they sold him off as a slave. You know the account. Or what about King Saul? King Saul, one day marching down the streets, everyone coming out and waving, and it was a military campaign that had gone well. And David is marching with them, and they say this, Saul has killed his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And suddenly, the Bible says, from that moment on, Saul had an awful spirit, anger and resentment against David. How dare they say, I've killed thousands, and this young twerp, this young man, this young soldier, he has been credited with tens of thousands. They've put me down and they've exalted him. What more do you want? You want the kingdom? Are you going to rob that away from me as well? And he becomes so angry. You know the account. He even tries killing David with his javelin on more than one occasion. Hates David, and he dies a bitter man. But what about in the New Testament, the account of Herodias? John the Baptist confronted Herodias and said, the life you're living and the man you're living with and all of this is not right in the sight of God. And he, rather than changing in her, rather than changing her ways, they became so angry that they wanted the head of John the Baptist on a platter. All started with a grudge. You know, someone has said, don't hold a grudge. Here's why. Because it allows someone to live in your head rent-free. Wow, that is true. You see, a grudge is a heavy load to carry around. And remember, we bear grudges, we carry grudges, we nurse grudges. It's a heavy load to carry around. You see, a grudge will, in time, it will suck away your strength, it will destroy your health, and it will kill your spirit. Here's what the Bible says that we are to do when things happen in life. And friends, As long as we're alive, there are going to be situations that can cause a grudge to take place. But here's how the Bible says we're to deal with daily life. In Colossians chapter 3, verses 12 to 14, says this, "Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another. If any of you has grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all of these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity." Many have heard me say that I grew up next door to Joseph and to Helen Wanamaker. I always referred to them as Grandpa and Grandma Wanamaker. What a blessing it was. My home would be like where Pastor Mark is right here, and just across the aisle. That's how close we lived. And because of living in the same duplex side by side, it was my privilege, not my duty, it was my privilege to go out and shovel their sidewalks and mow their grass, make runs to the store for them. When Grandpa and Grandma wanted to go out to eat, they loved to go to Barbier's. We would take him out to Barbier's. I don't know how many times we would sit down and say, "Oh, my brother, I forgot my teeth. Can you go home and get them for me?" And I'd come back carrying Grandpa's teeth. Incredible people that have shaped my life and shaped the life of many in the Milwaukee area, having started about 7 churches. Helen Wanamaker, Grandma Wanamaker, in her latter years became so that her mind was mostly, you know, her current memory, her short-term memory was mostly all gone. And so I'd come up to her door and I'd knock on the door to make sure everybody was okay. And she would come to the door and she would open the door and say, "Come in, honey, come in." She always called me honey. You'll know why in a minute. And so I would come in. She'd say, "Honey, sit down." I would sit down. "Honey, do you have time to talk?" "Oh, sure, Grandma, I've got time to talk." "Honey, let me tell you about how good God is." And she began to just pour into my life. She would tell us of the early days of the Assemblies of God, Pentecost in Milwaukee. Out of her would flow a grace. I've often said she could be the queen of any nation and do the job justice. She had such a grace about her. And so we'd be talking. She'd say, "Honey, are you hungry?" I'd say, "No, Grandma, I really don't need anything." And she'd say, "Oh, honey, I can't send you away without feeding you." And she'd go to the kitchen. She'd be in there for a little while, and she'd come out with a little sandwich cut in half. We would sit and we would talk, spend time together. And then invariably in the middle of the conversation, she would look at me and she would say, "Who are you, honey?" You know, what's the difference between that encounter and another that I met in a nursing home? They called her a cusser. Yeah. Little lady in her wheelchair, she had followed me around. As soon as I come in the door, blank, 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 blank. And I'd turn at her and look at her, you know, and I'd do everything but full out rebuke her. And she'd come right out and just go blank, 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 blank. I mean, she knew more words than any sailor I've ever met in my life. She was saying things that the wallpaper would begin to curl and fall off. She'd follow me around just blank, 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 cuss, cuss, cuss. In her room, there was a chart on the wall. Her chart had her name, not for the benefit of the visitor or of the nursing staff, but for her benefit. So her name was in big black letters on a red chart. On it would say, "Your last meal was," and would have the last meal, so she knew whether she had had breakfast or dinner or what was coming next. "Your next meal upcoming is," "Your last bath was Tuesday," "Your next bath is Thursday." So this chart on the wall told her who she was, when she last ate, what her next bath was. This lady was the cusser. She would tell me that she'd follow along, and you know, if I could get her to stop cussing long enough, she'd say, "My son, he's no good. My son never comes to see me." And the nursing staff would say, "He was here this morning." See, she began to live in such a delusion. And with her conscious memory now gone, all she had left is the grudges that she had borne, carried, nursed over a lifetime. What's the difference between the cusser and Grandma Wanamaker? It's all in what you dwell on, what you feed your soul, your heart, and your mind. And if the Lord should tarry, and I pray it happens to none of us, that possibly we won't know our name. It's possible that we won't even know our last meal or our next upcoming meal. But what we have thought about all life long, whether it's on the goodness of God or that we've held grudges, we've nursed that grudge, carried that grudge, held that grudge, or whether or not we've released it unto God.